This is PCJ Radio International.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Keith Perron.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. At the beginning of the month, we told you about two reporters from Radio France International who were killed in Mali, Ghislain Dupont and Claude Verlon. They were kidnapped by a terrorist group and then assassinated in the town of Kigal. Well, since we originally did the story, there have been so far more than 35 suspects who've been arrested, and it's still an ongoing investigation. To find out more about the kind of work they were doing and about Mali, we contacted our African correspondent David Smith in South Africa.
Oh my, Mali's been in a very difficult condition for a couple of years. I mean, what amounts to a civil war has been brewing either at high speed or low speed over the last couple of years. There was a military coup after a couple of Islamic fundamentalist groups took control of the northern part of the country, the part of the country that borders Algeria and Niger. And as the northern rebels were moving south towards the capital, Bamako, a cry for help went out first to the African Union to send in troops to help fight this threat. And when the African Union was not able to move quickly to send any sort of peacekeeping or peace-enforcing force, a call went out to the French. The French military arrived with a military group they call Operation Serval, and retook most of the north from the Islamic rebels. I say most of the north because there's one particular area in the northeast around a town called Kidal, K-I-D-A-L, not far from the Algerian and Niger border, that is, for all intents and purposes, sort of the wild northeast. It's almost out of control. There are French troops there. There are some Malian troops, and there are some troops belonging to a new, as of July 1st, UN peacekeeping force called MINUSMA, but there aren't enough of them in place to bring the place totally under control. And it's because of this chaos that the two French journalists from Radio France International were abducted on Saturday, and very shortly afterwards killed, and their bodies dumped on the side of the road about 15 kilometers outside of the town of Kidal.
Now, Claude Verlon and Ghislain Dupont have had, of course, a lot of experience covering various different parts of Africa. Was this the kind of place that, for example, if you are a foreign journalist and you're going into, you do have to take a lot of precautions? Would they have been prepared, you know, that something like this could have happened?
Well, several questions there, Keith. I think the most important thing to say is that if there are any two journalists who are accustomed, who were accustomed to dealing with extremely difficult situations, it's certainly Ghislain Dupont and Claude Verlon. Claude Verlon was more the technical guy. He's the guy who makes sure that there'd be a connection to the satellite and a good clear line whenever they were sending a report or sound from extremely isolated areas back to RFI's headquarters in Paris. And Ghislain Dupont, I don't underestimate when I say she was one of the very best journalists ever to have covered Africa for radio. And I say that with very first-hand experience. I had the enormous pleasure of working with Ghislain Dupont shortly after we launched Radio Okapi in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And Ghislain came for several months to help train the new team that would become Radio Okapi and would become the radio of reference for the DRC. And I should say that Ghislain Dupont was one of the great Congolese experts as far as radio journalism is concerned. So to get back to your question, yes, they would be very prepared. Did they know it was dangerous? Of course they knew. These are people who took chances to get stories and get behind stories that most other people never even tried to get. The kind of stories that most people would get either embedded with the military operation or sitting behind their desks and making phone calls. Ghislaine Dupont did not sit behind a desk, nor did Claude Berland. They went out and spoke to the people who were making the news.
You know, this is something, especially over the last 15 years, that we've seen a lot of correspondents overseas and either getting abducted or getting killed. And just recently, I was talking to a reporter who worked for the BBC for nearly 50 years. He's retired now, and he said there was a time when a foreign journalist can go into a hotspot, like he went into Vietnam, he covered the Korean War. He said you can actually go in certain areas that, let's say, were difficult or, you know, soldiers couldn't get to, but as a foreign journalist, you were sort of protected because the other side definitely wanted to get their word out. What do you think has happened?
Oh, my. What you said about, you know, all sides want publicity. There, you know, there's the old cliche, there's no such thing as bad publicity, there's only publicity. You know, another classic case in Africa is the head of the Lord's Resistance Army that comes from northern Uganda, where Joseph Kony leads an army made up to a large extent of child soldiers. And the Ugandan army has claims to have been chasing Mr. Kony for many years now and hasn't found him, but yet journalists managed to find him from time to time and interview him. That leads to a bigger question as to whether or not the Ugandan army actually really wants to find Mr. Kony, but we can save that interview for another time. Is it more difficult now? I think because of communications, the development of communications from very isolated spots, now that we have satellite phones and we can, you know, much of the continent, this continent that is linked with cell phone communication. I mean, we know a lot more about what's going on in difficult areas than we did before. If a journalist was going into a hotspot, often we didn't know about what they were doing, who they were talking about, until they went back to their home office and filed their piece. Now we know right from the source, right from the hotspots, what's going on as it happens. So maybe it's, to some extent, it's technology that's changed the rapidity in which we receive information from hotspots.
And what about for local journalists working in Mali? Do they face the same kind of challenges or even worse?
Oh, absolutely. Local journalists are killed all the time on this continent. I mean, the place where most local journalists die with far too much regularity is Somalia, the whole Horn of Africa area, where Somalian journalists are, you know, several times a year, sadly many times a year, being killed. The problem is, you know, local journalists don't always have the same international support group that somebody from a large international media house like Radio France International will have. That doesn't mean that one is better or more important or less important than the other. You know, our RFI has a worldwide network of listeners, something in the region of 40 million listeners, where, you know, take a community radio station in Somalia, they have several thousand listeners who don't have a lot of political clout. The president of the country is not likely to go on to national radio and TV and make an appeal for safety in their area. Whereas, you know, the moment news of the assassination of Ghislaine Dupont and Claude Berland reached Paris, you know, French President François Hollande and the head of RFI were very quick to make statements condemning what they justifiably call an onerous act.
I was just watching a press conference given by Marie-Christine Sargos, the CEO of France Media Monde, which owns Radio France International, and she said that, you know, she said she would like to come here and say that we're going to stop sending journalists there, but she says that's not going to happen.
Well, let's hope this is not just PR coming from her. I mean, it's a difficult time for anybody at RFI or in the business. I'm sure people at BBC and Deutsche Welle and other large international broadcasters are all questioning the work they're doing in difficult theaters right now. You know, I sincerely hope, for the sake of access to information and freedom of media, that RFE continues to cover Africa, especially the difficult parts of Africa, the way it always has. I think they will, but you know, we can understand if they take a moment to pause and think about what their next steps are going to be. Ghislaine Dupont and Claude Verlan were in northeastern Mali preparing for a special on the difficulties facing the Kidal area of Mali that was going to be aired on RFE later this month. That special program has now understandably been canceled. How many other things will be canceled because of this horrible event? I hope not many. I've listened to other journalists from RFE speak since the assassination, and I've only heard one message coming out, and that is, you know, the work that Ghislaine Dupont and Claude Verlan were doing will be continued by others.
David Smith, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure as always, Keith.
Over the last 20 years or so, we've seen many magazines on broadcasting close down, especially DX magazines and magazines that have to do with SWLs. One of the mainstays of shortwave broadcasting has been the Monitoring Times. Well, this too is coming at an end at the end of this year. Many people were wondering, well, what's going to happen now? Who is going to fill that void? Well, Ken Wrights, one of the editors of the Monitoring Times, has stepped in. They have formed a new publication, which will be available online through subscription, called the Spectrum Monitor. He now joins us on the program.
That's right, Keith. That's one of the things that that happened in the last couple of months when Bob Grove made his announcement that he was going to retire. Took the whole staff, of course, by surprise, and a lot of us were unhappy to at the prospect of not having anything to write about. After the December issue had finally been put to bed. And we've come to that point, as a matter of fact. We've just finished putting the December issue together, and that'll be out in another 2 weeks. It'll be at subscribers' hands, and that'll be the end of Monitoring Times. Well, the accolades just poured in to the headquarters at Monitoring Times, and it occurred to me that there was possibly enough interest in continuing a similar publication that was not associated with Bob Grove or Monitoring Times or Grove Enterprises, the publisher of MT. And so I put together a magazine. It's an electronic magazine called the Spectrum Monitor, and you can find out anything you want to know about it at thespectrummonitor.com. And if you want to find out who the writers are for TSM, I have a complete list on the website there, so just click on About Us and you'll find out who's writing. And it'll turn out to be almost everyone involved with Monitoring Times, all the columnists and feature writers that you're used to reading over the last couple of years are there, and we'll be here at the Spectrum Monitor. The first edition is the January issue, and it will come out December 15, when the January issue of Monitoring Times would ordinarily come out. So if you are interested in subscribing, we have a special price for charter subscribers, and all that information is on our website.
What's really amazing about this is, I mean, we've seen this with various different magazines, especially over the last few years. You know, they stopped publishing because there are so many different ways to get material these days. Do you think that part of the reason was because it was print? I mean, do you think, let's say, if Monitoring Times maybe 5 years ago said, you know what, we're going to do an e-version, do you think that maybe it would have continued?
No. In fact, what happened is in 1999, Monitoring Times started an electronic version and has continued for 14 years producing what's called MT Express. And it was delivered to people electronically exactly the way the Spectrum Monitor will be sent to its subscribers. But the problem is most people really still like to sit in a chair and hold a magazine in their hands, and I don't blame them. I feel the same way. The problem is that over the last 15 years, the cost of printing and publishing and distributing the entire magazine around the country and around North America is so expensive that it's prohibitive. We could not get enough people who subscribe to monitoring times to switch to the MT Express, the electronic version. And so as a result, as the years went by, Bob found himself unable to continue publishing the magazine as a print version, and was stuck because he couldn't get enough people to switch over. So since we're starting out without any paper whatsoever, I'm hoping that we have an advantage in that respect. We're not trying to make a newspaper or a magazine that's going to be available at newsstands around North America. There's a price for that, of course, and that is you have less distribution. But we're hoping that we can gain enough of our remaining audience of Monitoring Times, and apparently we're doing that. In the last 2 weeks, the Spectrum Monitor's website has only been up for 2 weeks, and we've had a tremendous response.
There must have been some people that said to you, "What, you're going to start a magazine about, you know, a technology that nobody really cares about anymore in 2014?
Well, that's right. But you know, the thing is, people who are interested in technology, and here's what's happening in radio today. Modern computer technology and modern radio technology are merging. And with the emergence of software-defined radios, for example, all of a sudden you're starting to attract people who really didn't know all that much about radios, but they were into computers, they were into the technology of the web, and all of a sudden they're learning about things like software-defined radios. They're learning about what you can do with them, which of course means shortwave radios, it means utility monitoring, it means longwave broadcast, shortwave amateur radio. And so these are the things that we're covering, we have covered for decades in Monitoring Times, and we will continue to cover in the Spectrum Monitor. Everything from amateur radio, shortwave, Wi-Fi, utility monitoring, satellites, longwave, you name it.
So there definitely is enough material out there then.
Oh, absolutely, and that is that's another aspect of publishing electronically, is that we're not hamstrung by a certain number of print pages that we have to fill. If we have an article that needs 4 or 5 pages to tell the story, then we can do that. If we have one that only needs a 1 page to do it, we can do that as well. So you know, you can the actual publication can expand and contract with each issue according to the amount of material you need to publish. We're going to have the same number of columnists, so the basic part of the magazine that people knew as Monitoring Times will continue with the Spectrum Monitor. For instance, we've got some excellent writers who have been writing for years. Dan Bieneman, for instance, on Scanning America. We have Kurt Kleinschmidt, who's the guru for amateur radio. We've got a lot of people. We have people covering long wave. We have people writing about computers and Wi-Fi radio. So there's a tremendous amount of material to cover in each month. And I'm always amazed at how much you can fill. I mean, we can put a lot more in if we get a lot more subscribers than we can afford to put more in. That's basically what it boils down to.
You know, what's interesting is just a moment ago you said, you know, about merging two different types of technologies together. And just recently, about a few weeks ago, somebody turned me on to Perseus. And they said, "You have to try Perseus." And I went, "Okay, I'll download the software for it." Well, guess what happened? You know, not too long after, I went and I had to buy a Perseus receiver.
Yes.
And it is absolutely fantastic. And it's on my desktop. And besides tuning to my own Perseus, what's nice is I can tune to any other Perseus around the world that happens to be connected at the internet at that time. And listen to something, let's say, locally, which is, it is astonishing. It's taking two technologies, one 100 years old and in modern technology, and combining the two.
Yes, that's exactly right. And a lot of people are finding their way to shortwave by way of the web. One of the things that's really interesting, and everyone talks about how shortwave transmitters are disappearing And it's true as far as the traditional old legacy broadcasters, Deutsche Welle, BBC, and Voice of America and so forth, cutting back drastically on their... And part of that has to do with the economy. It doesn't have to do with anything else other than it's too expensive to be running these at a time when worldwide economies are flat. But what's happening is people are coming to understand these where these broadcasts are through Wi-Fi radio. So people who were used to listening to their local AM and FM radio station, now they have a little Wi-Fi radio on their desk, and all of a sudden they're listening to BBC, they're streaming VOA, they're streaming really esoteric little shortwave radios and AM FM radios from all over the world. So what we're seeing today is this tremendous convergence of technologies that is that's making everything just so much more versatile. And one of the things that's happening is that there are so many products out there, and this is one thing that we intend to cover a lot in Spectrum Monitor, is different products. What products are available? What products work best? For instance, in the Wi-Fi department, there are a tremendous difference between various types of Wi-Fi radios. Some of them work extremely well. Some of them don't work quite as well. Some of them work terribly. Some of them have tremendous features, such as a full-color screen that you can look at, album cover jackets and that sort of thing. And others are simply a three-line monochromatic screen. So, you know, there's a lot to know about the technology that you're getting into, and that's another thing that we're hoping to cover in the Spectrum Monitor.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, especially about shortwave broadcasting these days, is, yes, it's true, you know, there's a number of shortwave sites that have gone silent, for example, like Sackville in Canada, and most recently the Spanish foreign radio site in Costa Rica. But the sites that are remaining, I mean, we live at a time now where if anybody out there can actually put a program on shortwave, it's at the most affordable that it has ever been.
Yes.
You know, and it's kind of like, okay, maybe one chapter is closing, one door has just closed, but it's like there's another door that is like opening up.
That's a really good point, Keith, and I think that's what we're seeing. The technology, we haven't seen an end to the growth in the technology, and one of the things that's most interesting, and you mentioned the SDRs just a little while ago, a lot of people are finding that with the super sensitive receivers such as Win Radio, for instance, these radios not only have the capability to zero in on extremely narrow banded frequencies, but they also have the capability of recording great swaths of RF, of HF spectrum, that you can pinpoint. So, for instance, let's suppose you are interested in a certain segment of the shortwave band that doesn't appear to have any activity. Well, you can set it up to record a tremendous amount of this bandwidth, and then come back later and review it, and you will see signals popping up here and there as you go back through the recording, and you can find out what they are. You can take a closer look at them. Are they digital recordings? Is there something that you can do to possibly tune those in? Is there a software you can use with your computer that can decode these programs or the data, or what is it? So it's bringing out the investigative in all shortwave listeners. This is a time. It's actually, I see it as a real new things are coming up on the horizon. Just as you say, behind us in the rearview mirror, the old things are disappearing over the horizon. But what we're seeing ahead of us is very, very interesting.
Now, I know that you probably can't say too much right now, but can you give us maybe a little bit of a scoop of what's in the first edition?
Oh, yes. We're going to have a couple of interesting stories, and one of them is about PCJ. Is that right, PCJ, the Happy Station?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, from before World War II in the Netherlands. And there's a really interesting story about what happened to that radio station, the title of the story is Philips Radio and the Unhappy Station. I won't give anything away on this because it's an extraordinary story. We're also taking a look at the interoperability issue, which in North America is a huge thing. As you know, since 9/11, there's been a tremendous push, which now is going into 12 years, to make all of the public service radio communications interoperable, so that you've got your fire department able to communicate with the police department, and so forth. And there's a lot of problems that have arisen in the ensuing 12 years, not the least of which is the exceeding expense of these systems, not just in money and time, but also in lives. So this is something we'll be looking closely at. We're also going to be looking at, we're having Kurt Kleinschmidt put together a Geeks Look at Radio. So we're trying to introduce people who aren't necessarily familiar with radio technology, but are really up on their computers to take a look at this, what we're calling this convergence of technologies, computers and radio. And those are just a couple of things we're looking at. We're also looking at the FAA is coming up with a new system, which is partly being used in Europe right now, for directing air traffic control by using satellites instead of traditional VHF and UHF ground frequencies. So we're looking at that as well. And, of course, each of our columnists will be covering their own specialties. We've got long-wave columnists and short-wave columnists and scanner columnists and everything in between.
Ken, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Keith.
Now, we just heard a moment ago some very positive news. Yes, the Monitoring Times is going into history, but a new magazine is starting up, available, of course, online. Now, let's talk about transmitter sites for a moment. Over the last 20 years, we have seen transmitter sites close down. For example, there was the Bethany site in the United States that was run by the Voice of America. Then, Radio Canada International Sackville site, the Radio Netherlands site in Bonaire, and just recently, the Radio Exterior de España site in Costa Rica. So it was looking like a lot of doom and gloom. Well, this is not exactly the case. Another site in the Northern Hemisphere that also shut down was the WYFR site in Okeechobee, Florida. This was a site that was managed and operated by Family Radio. They have more than 10 transmitters and more than 20 fantastic antennas, mostly running at 100 kilowatt, including 150 kilowatt transmitter. Well, guess what has happened? Well, those of you who are listening to this program right now on Radio Miami International on 9,955 kilohertz, well, at this very moment, this is the final day from their Miami relay station, because Radio Miami International is taking over the relay site. So our good friend Jeff White is going to be probably the largest shortwave operator in the Americas. Well, to find out more, we're now joined by the man himself with some excellent and positive news. So, Jeff, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Well, to make a very long story short, the unexpected has happened, the unplanned has happened, and I'm still finding it a little hard to believe myself, but it was suggested to me by a few people when WYFR went off the air at the end of June that because of our proximity here that Radio Miami ought to consider taking it over. And my wife jokingly said, well, if we win the lottery, maybe we could. But that didn't happen. But in a way, I guess we did, because we had some tremendous help from Dan Elliott, who was WYFR station manager from the time it was built until the time it went off the air, who was my predecessor as secretary treasurer of the National Association of Shortwave Broadcasters here. He put us in touch with the family radio people in California, and there were an awful lot of obstacles that had to be overcome, and things that I in the beginning thought could not be overcome. But one obstacle after another just kept falling away, and everything started falling into place. And here we are, after just several weeks of negotiations, I guess. But it looks like it's happening on December 1st. We're going to be shutting down WRMI in Miami, the transmitter site, that is. We'll keep our office in Miami. And that will be the last day of transmissions should be November 30th, and then the next day, December 1st, we'll be moving those transmissions to the WYFR site in Okeechobee.
So, Jeff, you're going to be going from 150 kilowatt transmitter to much higher power transmitters then.
Yes, there are currently 13 100 kilowatt transmitters in Okeechobee and one 50 kilowatt transmitter. And we're going from one antenna, one and a half, it's sort of been working sometimes, to 23 antennas going in all directions in a circle around the globe, around the transmitter building there. So it's an incredible change.
So the frequency that you're currently using, 9955, will that still be in use, or will you also now have the option, more options of using different frequencies?
Yes, we will continue most all of the programming that is currently on 9955 kilohertz will continue on 9955 kilohertz, but instead of coming from Miami, it will come from Okeechobee. However, we are also making the site available to other international broadcasters who are interested in, using the facility. We certainly can't occupy 13 transmitters. 24 hours a day. So there are, I can mention, for example, Pan American Broadcasting from California is going to be transmitting its Radio Africa programming from Okeechobee for, I believe, 9 hours a day, in addition to Radio Miami. And we're working on several other contracts with other organizations that seem to be interested in using Okeechobee as well.
So let me ask you.
Of course, those will be on other frequencies.
Right. Now, this transmitter site, it's been around for a number of years. What kind of transmitters are there, and have they been well-maintained?
They've been impeccably maintained. They are, some of them, quite old. Going back to, I think, even one or two of them may have come from the original site in Scituate, Massachusetts, and been moved down there. Some of them are quite a bit newer, from the 1980s, but they've been impeccably maintained by engineers I have found that really know what they're doing, and have cared for this site very, very well over the years. Some of them have been there for 28, 30 years or more, and so they know this place inside and out. Everything is in really good shape, and it has its age. It's all in working order. And in fact, up until June 30th, it was working.
Well, age doesn't mean anything. The BBC Far East relay station in Singapore, which was built in the 60s, is still cranking out every day programs from BBC and other broadcasters, just as it did when it first went on the air. So let me ask you then, with this site at Okeechobee, if you compare it, let's say, to other shortwave transmitter sites in the United States, is it one of the largest?
Well, I think it is. I was told that it was the largest in the United States in terms of number of transmitters and antennas, 13 transmitters and 23 antennas. There's at least one other site I can think of that has more power, and that would be WEWN in Alabama, because I believe they have 400 or 500 kilowatt transmitters, and probably a large number of antennas as well. I'm not sure the exact number, but so they probably have more power than Okeechobee does, but they don't have as many transmitters. The only other one that I think would come close would be VOA or IBB in Greenville, North Carolina, which I believe still doesn't have quite as many transmitters and antennas overall as Okeechobee. And could be mistaken on that, but in any case, it's big.
Jeff, thank you very much for talking to us today. It's really nice to hear some good news, actually, for a change coming from your part of the world.
Well, thank you, Keith, and we're glad to be able to bring it to you.
And I was speaking there with Jeff White from Radio Miami International, and you can check them online. And just to let you know, in December, we're going to be doing a special transmission from their news site in Okeechobee, targeting listeners in North America. So you can find the details that will be published at our website, pcjmedia.com. Let's now move to Melissa Chan. Melissa Chan worked for a number of years for Al Jazeera English. She was based in Beijing. And then, all of a sudden, she was expelled from the country. Now, it's been a number of years, of course, that China has expelled journalists from China, and she's still unclear about why it happened. She speaks next to our good friend, Richard Adie.
I actually don't know. I know that sounds a bit like a cop-out answer, but the fact of the matter is that the Chinese government has never really come out officially and provided an explanation. So, looking at my work, you can say, well, you know, she did a lot of human rights reports. But the fact of the matter is, and this is not modesty speaking, the fact of the matter is a lot of television correspondents in Beijing did human rights stories. And in fact, I wasn't the only one who did stories such as black jails, extra-legal detention centers, and so on and so forth.
I was going to say, maybe that in particular, though, because you did a cracking series of stories on these illegal detention centers, which are not really supposed to exist at all, but clearly do. And maybe that was the thing that really got under their skin.
It could have been. I certainly filed a report on black jails the month, actually a couple of weeks before my departure. I also tried to interview a human rights attorney in Beijing at around the same time as well, a couple of weeks before my departure. But that's just one possibility, really. The authorities had expressed unhappiness with a few documentaries I was actually not involved in regarding prison labor in China.
But they'd come from Al Jazeera English.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. I was sort of perhaps guilty by association. Some people have floated the possibility that I am ethnically Chinese and the Chinese authorities...
You're definitely ethnically Chinese.
Well, I mean, they throw the idea that I, as a result of being ethnically Chinese, the Chinese authorities have a double standard. And it's somehow okay for a total foreigner to bumble around China doing human rights stories, but that as an ethnic Chinese, I am somehow a traitor to my motherland. And they don't see the fact that I'm a U.S. passport holder as a differential. But I'm actually not quite sure how that actually fits in. It's interesting, and it's a hypothesis, and that's why I sort of backtrack and say I actually don't know why this expulsion took place, because there could be a multiplicity of reasons, and I joke that it won't be until, you know, if this ever happens, if this current, this current government in China falls, and I can walk down the halls of the Chinese Foreign Ministry, pull out my dossier from the file cabinet, and that's when I will know. But until then, my guess is as good as anyone else's, frankly.
I don't like your chances of that, I got to say. Did you have a sense that this might be coming before it happened? You said that they weren't happy with stories that Al Jazeera English had done.
Well, here's the thing. The Chinese authorities had not expelled a correspondent in more than a decade, 14 years or so.
Yeah, it was a long time.
So, you know, they put a lot of pressure on foreign correspondents in Beijing, not just me. And I guess to a certain extent, you always think that they were just really putting the pressure on, but they wouldn't actually ask you to leave the country because they hadn't done that in so long. So it did come as a shock to me. I was certainly shocked and had to have, you know, the first 48 hours, I was definitely a bit shell-shocked, for sure, because you just didn't think that they would go through with it. And, you know, I like to tell this story about the relationship that the government has with Al Jazeera English. In the early days when the channel launched in late 2006, early 2007, I think the Chinese welcomed Al Jazeera as an alternative to Western press coverage, CNN, BBC, and so on and so forth. And they remarked as much in our meetings with them when we had those meetings with the Chinese Foreign Ministry. But as the years passed, you know, I think that they realized that we were going to do the job of any other journalist. And if bad things happen in China, we would cover it. And I think that they were somehow shocked over this possibility and have had a difficult time coming to terms with the fact that Al Jazeera English is a bona fide news organization.
Interestingly, a new study from the Center for International Media Assistance, which is a US-based NGO which is about developing media in different countries, says the Chinese Communist Party is increasingly muscular in restricting and censoring international news outlets. And maybe I'm wondering if your expulsion was kind of the beginning of a difference.
It could be viewed as the beginning of a shift in terms of their treatment of the Foreign Press Corps. One thing that has not been really covered as much as my departure, even though I think in many ways it's de facto the same situation, is Chris Buckley, the correspondent for the New York Times, who has essentially been based out of Hong Kong, even though he was ostensibly hired to be a China correspondent, because the authorities have never given him a visa. And he's still waiting. And as is Austin Ramsey, another new hire to the New York Times and former Time correspondent based in Beijing, who is currently in Hong Kong waiting for his visa.
That's like the old days of China's correspondents when they all were based in Hong Kong, if you go back to the 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's funny about the situation. It is like the old days. I mean, look, I think it's somewhat not fair. There is the existence of the internet and there's a lot more information available in China. But you're getting a little of this throwback, you know, with this new leadership in China to a certain extent, like, you know, over the past year, and not just to foreign correspondents, but also with the Chinese press.
Actually, that New York Times stuff, I think that goes back to reporting they did on the family of Wu Jingtao, making a lot of money being dollar billionaires and the Chinese government at the time being very unhappy with the New York Times.
Yeah, the premier, Wen Jiabao, I think that was their big thing. But also, if you recall, they pretty much called out the Chinese government for hacking into their email systems. And that report came out, I think, January, February of this year. So when I read that article, and, you know, it's very brave of the New York Times to have made that editorial decision because, you know, they were already under heat for their investigative reporting on Premier Wen Jiabao or then Premier Wen Jiabao. And then they essentially called out the Chinese and said, you hacked into our systems and this is how you did it. You know, that really sealed the fate. I thought, gee, you know, that's very brave of them. Those correspondents waiting to get their visas aren't going to be able to get it. And what's really interesting, you know, of course, is the actual correspondent who did that investigation of Premier Wen Jiabao is still in Shanghai and he still is properly accredited. The Chinese are quite smart, I think, to a certain extent. They punished a separate correspondent. So it wasn't as direct as punishing the correspondent who worked on the piece that pissed them off.
Now, you mentioned the New York Times annoying the Chinese government with the story about being hacked. That gets us nicely, I think, into the work that you've been doing over the last year. You took up a night fellowship at Stanford, and you were looking at digital security, at tools for journalists who are being targeted by state-sponsored hackers. What conclusions did you come to?
The sad conclusion is that it's a losing battle. I tried to look at, there is a lot of work being done in Silicon Valley and elsewhere in terms of tools that not only journalists but activists can use to better protect themselves, not just in China, but obviously in places like the Middle East. And the takeaway from all of this is that nothing is absolutely foolproof. You know, you can install a software that will help you anonymously surf the internet or get you past firewalls, but there's just no guarantee. If somebody really wants to go after your email inbox or really wants to see what's on your computer, they will find a way. They are far more sophisticated. They're just, you know...
It's unfair, isn't it? Journalists do not have the same technical skills as hackers, just not even close.
The conclusion is, well, what can you do, right? And the conclusion is to not use your laptop, don't communicate via email, and instead go back to old-fashioned pen and paper and meet people one-on-one in person to do your investigative journalism. You know, one thing is, you know, if you absolutely have to communicate via email, there are things that you can do to make it harder for hackers. Certainly you need to be vigilant. Don't open attachments. Don't click on links. And even if there are links and attachments from people you think you know and their addresses, but also to, if you're using Gmail, make sure that you have the two-step verification set up. And what that is sort of like an additional key to the door that's goes into your email inbox. And those are useful things. And also going into countries like China and the Middle East, you can use clean laptops, or even better, some people are suggesting Google Chromebooks because there's no hard drive and therefore no information on them. You have to kind of access it via the cloud. So unless somebody just grabs you and tortures you into giving up your password, they can't really access the information. And I think it's also a common phrase they use is the threat model, like who is your threat? And in China, I knew who I had to protect myself against, right? And in the United States, at least right now, I'm not doing the kind of investigative work that will perhaps get the attention of the NSA.
Doesn't mean they're not watching.
No, no. And so you sort of have to base what story you're working on and who you don't want to access that information and then act accordingly. And that's the way that the security folks sort of also explain it. You can't be paranoid and vigilant for everything.
What about you? Do you want to go back?
I'd like to go back because I was a correspondent based there for 5 years.
Mm. Did some good stuff.
Thank you. And I'm fluent in Mandarin and Cantonese Chinese, so I'm well placed to cover that country, and I enjoyed myself for those 5 years.
And it's got to be one of the great beats of the world for a reporter,
doesn't it? Oh, absolutely. It was a dream. And I'd like to go back. It's nice to actually get a break from China, even though it wasn't exactly the way I wanted to depart. The air there is terrible and the quality of life is terrible. So after 5 years in Beijing, breathing that air, it takes a toll on you. But eventually I'd like to go back. I suspect I won't be able to for a few years as a accredited journalist. I hope to be able to go back as a tourist at some point. But I think it might be a few more years before I can go back as a journalist.
Richard Ady speaking to Melissa Chan, who was expelled from China. Now, just a couple of weeks ago, I received an email from a listener of ours, a regular shortwave listener by the name of Dan Van Hoy, who lives in Hong Kong. He has a receiver in Hong Kong that's part of the Global Tuners website, where you can log on to different radio tuners around the world and listen to either domestic radio or shortwave broadcast in the region. He is connected with Sea Crane Radio in the United States. Now, many of you, of course, are familiar with that brand of radio. Well, he called to tell me, or rather send me an email to let me know, that Bob Crane, the president and founder, was going to be in Taiwan. So, of course, we're going to meet up. I mean, it would be ridiculous not to meet up. So we met up for dinner and then headed back to the hotel and we sat down for a little chat. My first question to Bob was, how did he get involved in radio?
Oh, I love radio. I always loved radio since I was a little kid, you know, listening to get the prayer cloth from Reverend Ike out of Texas on DXN. And I moved to the woods and I couldn't hear my distant AM signals. And I found a great gentleman in Wisconsin who makes a loop antenna in his basement. And I called him, I got one, and it worked. So I got AM stations 300 miles away. And when it worked, I had the idea immediately. I said, I gotta sell this to other people. So it was wonderful. We went on to create a couple models of our own. We invented them, even though they said it couldn't be done. So that was fun. And we soon realized that people wanted the antenna built into the radio. So we eventually did that too.
Now, the early radios that you built, did you have a company facility, or did you just do everything out of your basement or your garage at home?
Definitely out of the home. Mm-hmm. That's the way it worked until people started showing up on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. That got old. And then the funniest part was, this could be considered bragging, but it's not. We looked out. We had a tenth of a mile gravel road to our front door, and there was cars lined up to our front door. And that's when we knew we had to move.
So the radios that you have now on the market and had back then, are they all designed and developed by C-Crane, or does it happen, for example, we see this like with mobile phone makers, they'll see maybe a company in the Far East that makes a product and they put their name on it and then sell it?
Well, we did sell other radios from other manufacturers, sure. We tried to pick the best ones and market those to our customers. We did videos on how to use some of the more complex ones. But we always knew we wanted to make our own. So then in 1989, we started to put our ideas together, and it finally took 10 years later. We had to convince a company to support us to build the original CC radio.
And what kind of radios do you focus on? Is it just standard AM and FM, or shortwave and ham band and air band and all the other bands you can think of?
You know, that's a curious question, but I think the answer is as curious as we are as humans and our individual needs. And maybe we put like 2 meter ham band on one of our more popular radios because it's to encourage the use of that band. It also works great in a disaster. But people that I'm sure we've opened up the world for a ham radio, for people to become a ham, maybe not millions and millions, but it's fun. Radio is fun. It's a wonderful thing.
There must be some people that have said to you, radio's dying, it's going away, maybe you should just get away from this product line. I sort of disagree with that because I think that radio still has a very, very long life in it. I mean, we were just talking about this earlier, we were talking about AM radio in the United States, which is, if you compare, let's say, to Canada, is very popular.
Yeah, the senior band is doing rather well. So it's funny because TV has dropped almost in half the audience, conventional network TV. FM has dropped 30%, and AM radio has only dropped 20%. So let me tell you how bad I think it is. I think it's doing great considering all the other attention-getting media that everybody is subjected to every day. So I think AM radio is doing fantastic, and the future looks good.
And what about new radios that we've seen come on the market in the last 10 years? Do you also build them, for example, like Wi-Fi radios?
Sure. We started with Wi-Fi radio. We were the first one to bring one into the United States, a good one. And we think it's a great form of entertainment if you love radio. It's incredible.
Well, I mean, with Wi-Fi radios, a lot of people would say that, especially today, anybody can be an international broadcaster, especially with a Wi-Fi radio. I mean, for Wi-Fi radios yourself, do you see, there was a period where it was very slow in growth. And what about now in 2013?
Well, Wi-Fi radios is, in some areas, like in Europe, really went bonkers there for quite a while. In the United States, it grew rather fast. But I think it's kind of stabilized. It has, a modest growth right now going up, but it's nothing spectacular. It didn't take off like I probably thought it would and take over the whole universe, but it's still strong. Yeah, it's still strong.
Now, you've been at this now for more than 20 years.
Yes.
When you look at all this time that has gone by, did you ever think that after all these years you would still be in this business, or do you think that maybe you would have moved on to something else?
Probably a sane man would have moved on, possibly. But I sincerely love radio and what it offers. It fits with who I am. I just can't tell you. You can do so many things. I like to work. Well, you can't work when the TV's on. Mm-hmm. The knowledge you gain from radio is tremendous. It's very entertaining for music and talk and everything else. So I think I cut off my TV a few years ago for conventional network TV, and I love it.
So as a radio listener, what kind of things do you listen to?
Boy, it's really diverse. I sponsor the Coast to Coast show at night now, so I listen to that usually. I'll tune it over to Bloomberg Business Radio at night when I get home. I force myself to pick a new Wi-Fi station once a week and see what I find, and that's really fun. So it's really diverse. I pick up some of my old stations that I listened to when I was a kid, direct, not through Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And then local stations, have some great local stations where we live up in the Fortuna area of California. So that occupies quite a few hours of listening right there.
And how do you see the future of radio in this iPad, iPod, internet world?
I think you have to separate how you listen to it from the device. So whatever is most convenient and what you like is what you're going to use to listen to it. But the audio on cell phone sucks. So we're going to have to fix that too.
Bob Crane, the president and founder of C. Crane Radio. For more information on all the receivers that they have, and antennas and everything else, their website is cccrane.com. That's CCRANE.com. Well, before we end off, let's now take a look at what we can expect propagation-wise over the next 7 days. Here's our propagation editor, Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from November 30th to December 6th, 2013. The 10.7-centimeter flux starts out on November 30th and December 1st at 135 up to 140, December 2nd, on December 3rd and 4th, 145 up to 150, December 5th and 6th. The A index for the first 4 days of the week is 5. That's from November 30th to December 3rd, spiking at 10 on December 4th, down to 5 on December 5th, and on December 6th, spiking once more at 15. The KP index is steady at 2 from November 30th to December 3rd, going up to 3 on December 4th, down to 2 December 5th, spiking at 4 on December 6th. Sunspots 1903 through 1906 are present this week. 1903 and 04 are on the sun's east side, and 05 and 06 are on the sun's west side. 1904 and 05 have beta gamma magnetic fields that harbor energy for M-class solar flares. Neither sunspot, however, is facing Earth nor actively flaring. No coronal holes are observed this week. There's a new phone app available that allows people to monitor the sun. You can read more about that at our radio propagation page, www.pcjmedia.com/RPROP. Back to you, Keith.
And, well, that's it. That's all we have time for on the monthly edition of Media Network Plus. If you want to get in touch with us, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. I also invite you to listen to the weekly edition, heard on the World Radio Network and through fine partner stations everywhere. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.